smoke pours from one of Doha's most popular shopping malls. Called Villaggio, it's a destination for locals and the thousands of expatriate workers and their families who live in Qatar. As firefighters battled the blaze, they were joined by this woman who said children were inside.
Do we know that our family...
Well, the government held a press conference an hour or so ago now and gave us some more details. Firstly, that they say the fire started in the nursery, which was really in the centre of the mall. It's a place called Chimpanzee, which only had exits that led out within the mall, so it had no external exits. There'll be lots of speculation about it starting in other areas, like the food court, but that seems to be where it started. And we've learnt some devastating details. I've just found out that three siblings died in the fire. In fact, I'm a member of a mother's group here, and the mother, I think, is another member. It's just simply devastating. The community here is really very small. The expat community is very tight. Qatar's a small country, obviously, and we all feel it. It's enormously upsetting.
Yes, indeed. And I gather the firefighters, when they turned up, they were just simply too late to save all those involved, many children.
Yes, it seems that what happened was they turned up pretty quickly, about 8 minutes after the alarm was raised, but they weren't told that there was a nursery inside. And also there was some issue apparently with emergency diagrams for the mall. The exits weren't marked properly, so they sort of had to make do, and although there were people outside telling them there were children inside, I think they just were not officially notified, so it took far too long for them to realise what was going on. And when they did rush in, it was too late, and two of the firemen died trying to save the children.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Rice, and you're listening to Two Fat Expats. You will have noticed that we have a different intro today. It didn't feel right to have the normal theme song with its normal upbeat music, because this isn't one of our normal episodes. Today's podcast is all about when the normal disappears and when the unimaginable happens. On the morning of May 28th, 2012, a group of expat families woke up to what they thought would be a day just like any other. They fed their children breakfast, got them dressed and ready to go to nursery school. They packed lunch boxes, filled water bottles, and then buckled them into car seats. After dropping their children and kissing them goodbye, they went about their daily routines. Some of them went straight to the office. Others, like Jane Weeks, mother of triplets Lily, Jackson and Wilshire, or Winky as her and Martin referred to him, made their way to the grocery store. Within the next couple of hours, as Doha went about its morning, a fire broke out in the back room of a sporting store, a store which backed on to the Chimpanzee nursery. Inside that nursery were 13 children and 4 staff, all of whom would lose their lives. Today, I'm going to begin the show by talking to Jane Weeks about how her expat life changed that day after she lived through mine, and if you have children, probably your worst nightmare.
I had to do some supermarket shopping at Hyatt Plaza, the shopping mall literally just across the road from Bellagio. And I was in the supermarket there when my husband called and said, "You need to go get the kids from school, there's a fire at Bellagio." And I didn't really appreciate the seriousness of it. I mean, I dumped the trolley and ran out to get my car and saw the cars streaming out of the car park and the smoke coming out of the building. At no point sort of immediately did I think that they wouldn't have evacuated the children. However, when I tried ringing the school when there was no answer, and the only reason I was kind of able to stay close to Villaggio is I ended up sitting with a fire emergency vehicle who was just having, "Oh, there's nothing to worry about, but you could really see that there was, and it took a long time before anyone had any information of, you know, where are the children? There's children in there. They haven't come out. And there's a lot of things we've heard afterwards that happened within the mall that really contributed to to what happened. Some things are a little bit anecdotal, but you kind of hear them from a couple of different places. Things like, you know, the teachers called security and security said, oh, don't worry about it, false alarm, just stay there. Whereas here in New Zealand, false alarms, everyone is expected to leave the building anyway because nobody knows to the extent it is. There's this perception, particularly with security staff who quite often come from, you know, subcontinent, you know, from India or Pakistan, they're not empowered to make decisions. And they're treated really poorly if they make what's perceived to be the wrong decision. So what happens tends to be inactivity. So rather than erring on the cautious side and actually working to evacuate, nobody did. We've also been told that the teachers were told to stay where they are. So, and that's the thing also with the teachers, is why there should have been an evacuation plan run through with the management of the school. There should have been drills. There wasn't. They had no idea that the emergency exits had been blocked off. If they'd actually had proper drills, they would have known that.
The fire safety door was had something up against it, or it was locked, wasn't it? And they couldn't open those evacuation doors. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Plus, not all of the alarms sounded, though parts of the mall had no idea what was going on.
So, Jane, when you eventually got to the mall, I imagine you were trying to get in there or find the children. Were most of the parents there with you at that time?
Not initially, because it's so spread out at the different entrances and I wasn't allowed past a certain point. I was only sort of allowed past a certain point after my husband had arrived, and they basically said they were bringing the children out, which, you know, at the time we didn't realise exactly what that meant. And the first I really understood of the severity of it was seeing several of them lying on the ground covered in sheets, and my husband saying that, you know, that they'd pulled Lily, my daughter, out and that they were working on her. And when somebody says working on them, that usually means, you know, unresponsive, or it's kind of the worst type of... The struggle that we had was, whilst we'd seen my daughter come out, nobody could tell us where our boys were. So they were still trying to do CPR on Lily. She was put in the ambulance, and I rode in the ambulance to the hospital with her, whilst my husband waited at the mall to see where Jackson and Winky were.
Jane, I guess now when you think of getting home and having Martin there and sort of the next few days, did the anger just start immediately of how on earth did this happen?
I was too in absolute shock, and it just, even the sort of shock and pain is so unfathomable, and there's not even words that you can really use to describe it. However, I didn't initially think that it was because of negligence. Sort of in my head it was, you know, it must have gotten so big so fast, you know, or, you know, what's explosion, or, and it really wasn't until, you know, as days kind of passed that we realised that each of the people involved had not done anything to protect the children. It was their responsibility to have systems in place so that when something happened, the people underneath them, the teachers and things like that, all knew what to do. But they didn't. They didn't have anything like that. And it took a while for me to actually get really angry about it, because I just didn't have the kind of the emotion left. We were just trying to survive. Even now, I'm still really angry. I actually have it in myself to forgive, but it feels like they've all moved on, like, oh, you know, we didn't do anything wrong.
So, Jane, how much longer did you stay in Qatar before you went back to New Zealand?
Ironically, Martin and I left New Zealand 2 days after we got married, and we flew back from Qatar with the children and the hold of the aircraft on our wedding anniversary.
Oh.
So, it was about 5 days.
Once you were back in New Zealand with family and friends, I'm trying to think of that feeling too, if you can describe, because I don't know how you even contemplate what the next step is. Like, were you thinking at that stage, we'll return to Qatar and return back to life, or were you thinking, I can't go back there again?
Before we left, I kind of thought that I would, and you know, grief does some pretty weird things. And I even remember walking out of the hospital and thinking that, you know, if, you know, when we come back, you know, to take all the things that I've learnt, that I want to do something to make sure nobody else has an experience like we did at this hospital. You know, coming from, you know, really people-centred roles and looking at people development and sort of customer service and caring type roles, it was kind of in my head that, yeah, I'd come back and maybe try and help them do things better, should God forbid it happen again. But it didn't take long, I think, of being at home that we kind of realised that, you know, well, what would we go back to?
So, Jane, what do you think they could have done better?
I mean, the way we were treated at the hospital was appalling. I came in on ambulance with my daughter, who was being given CPR, and they wouldn't let me see her. And they wouldn't tell me how she was. And all I got from these women in the hospital is, oh, inshallah, she will be all right, inshallah, she will be all right, which, you know, the worst thing that you can do in a situation like that is, you know, correct information is, you know, one of the key things that people remember after any traumatic event is that sort of influences how they look back on it. And, or actually, you know, the way that that things were responded to. And that was something that didn't happen. We were literally kind of shepherded around the hospital until we were told that all the children were dead. Except we weren't told the children were dead. We were shown, all the husbands were shown photos on a cell phone of the children so that we could identify which children were ours. And then it was a case of, in fact, my husband was only able to identify two of ours because there was so much soot on Will Winky's face that it was hard to tell who he was. And the hospital told him that, no, that can't be your son because it's a girl. That was him, so. And then they basically allotted everyone appointment times to come back the next day to see the bodies of their children.
There were court cases that were sort of that kept getting pushed back as well. How long did this go on for with you?
Well over a year. This is something I think it's really important for expats to understand, people looking to come to a country like that. It's when something happens and you can't go back, if you are only looking at going back for court cases, you're going to be doing it over and over and over and over, because the defendants didn't have to turn up, and they didn't. They just not turn up for court, so they put a stay on the trial. And it took months before a judge actually insisted that the defendants to the manslaughter of 13 children, four teachers and two firefighters, were even made to turn up in court. So court appearance after court appearance, the families of the children and the teachers that died would turn up in court. The defendants wouldn't. Things in court, it's in Arabic, they will not let you have translators. So if you don't speak Arabic, you have no idea what is going on in there. All of the court documentation is in Arabic. They will not help you have it translated into English. You have to be really careful about what you're given to sign and things like that, because there'll be no English translation. And unless you have somebody you fully trust to translate it to you in English, you have no idea what you're signing.
So how have you dealt with that, Jane? I imagine you've had to employ people all the way through to help you with this process?
The New Zealand Ministry of Foreign Affairs were based out of Riyadh and Saudi, were really good about attending the trials. They have staff that speak Arabic. We employed a local lawyer, plus we were in close contact with the other families who also lost children.
So, Jane, tell me about what's happening in your life now.
Well, after the kids' funeral, being back in New Zealand, we'd come back to New Zealand. It was the middle of winter. We moved into an apartment in Wellington City. It was grey and cold and miserable, and we had nothing to do, which you know, hadn't had nothing to do since well before the babies were born. And it was really dangerously depressing. So my husband and I actually went back overseas to see some family and some friends. It was literally trying to run away, really. We then underwent IVF in San Francisco and were really lucky to sort of become pregnant with Poppy and Parker in December of 2012. So that was kind of just over 6 months after the fire. And then from there we came back to New Zealand and kind of to figure out where are we going to settle, what are we going to do. So we found a house in a really, really amazing neighbourhood with a really close sense of community. And did the Kiwi thing of, you know, house renovate when the babies are 3 months old, and I started university when they were 8 months old. And actually just really don't feel that the corporate world would suit me anymore. I keep picturing myself sort of being in the type of job I was in last time, you know, when with, you know, sort of people quibbling or not treating each other well over money and things like that. And I'd probably just turn around and walk out of the room. And well, that's probably the best case scenario. Otherwise, I'd probably be looking at people going, and you really think that's important? Really, really, your understanding of priorities, particularly for me and Martin, is just completely, I wouldn't say upturned, but it gives you more of an appreciation of what actually is the small stuff and why would you bother sweating it.
And so what was the course that you took? What is it called?
Bachelor's of Counselling. So I have a counselling degree now.
And have you started work as yet?
I've done little bits and pieces. We do a number of, sort of placement hours whilst we're studying. I only finished my degree kind of 3 months ago, and unfortunately last year, towards the beginning of the year, my mother was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, and she died at the end of May. So last year was not a great year. I still finished my degree at the end of the year, but really made a conscious effort to say, actually, I need some time just to not have to do anything and get to spend time with friends and family without constantly going, gosh, what is it that I'm forgetting to do? You know, have I got another assignment to write? Or, oh, no, I can't do that because I've got to be somewhere. So actually, when you called, I was actually just in the middle of getting together my New Zealand Association of Counsellors application for registration to officially start working.
What would your advice be for how you've got through some of this and what some of your tools have been?
I think, and it's really difficult to see it, but you know, the really acute just drowning in how awful and enormous it is to lose a child or children. It doesn't stay that huge forever, that there actually will be, you know, eventually there will be kind of moments and then minutes and hours that actually you do find things that you can enjoy. The idea of closure is just completely not true. There's never closure over losing a child. You don't get over it. You just kind of learn to live with it. And the fact that, you know, I'll always, you know, if I could rewind the tape to undo what happened that day, I would sell my soul to do it. But that doesn't mean that I don't get just as much joy out of Poppy and Parker or friends and family. And I read something recently in a book written by a woman called Lucy Honey, who's a psychologist actually, and she specializes in helping people in traumatic situations, and horrifically she lost her daughter in a car accident. So she was written a really good book about ways that were useful for her, and something that she said that really struck me is resilience is the norm. People do survive and go on to live good and happy and healthy lives. That's actually normal. And the number of people say, if something happened to one of my children, I couldn't live, I couldn't move on. Actually, you can.
you carry it with you, and sometimes you really have to work on it, and you really have to work it. Yeah, Martin and I used to do, we used to say, well, you know, we'll fake it till we make it. Sometimes we'd drag ourselves out of the house to go for a walk and try and pretend everything was okay when it wasn't. And sometimes you have to try, you know, you don't have to try quite as hard. And sometimes you don't have to try at all. So it's, yeah, there's always hope.
Now, Jen, I have another girlfriend who lost a child when we were living in Jakarta, and one of the things that drove her nuts was the amount of people that felt the need to tell her her marriage was going to break down because of the statistics of marriages that break down when a child is lost.
Yeah.
Did you have to go through that as well?
No, and the actually interesting thing is that statistic is actually not true. Actually more likely it pretends to bring marriages together. If your marriage is falling apart, it's going to fall apart regardless of what happens to your kids. Your kids might be angels and your marriage will still fall apart if it's not right and there's stuff going on. But healthy marriages don't tend to break up because a child dies, and that's quoted in some of my textbooks, so
yeah, that's actually, to that I just say bollocks, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Mark and we couldn't have got through it without each other. And the thing with loss, though, is you've got to remember everyone grieves at a different pace and has different feelings at different times. And the hardest thing in the marriage is what happens if one of you's having a good day and the other one of you's having an awful day. And trying to balance that, supporting each other but not bringing each other, being able to recognise to sort of try not to bring each other down as well. So there's a, you know, respecting that people grieve in different ways. And that can be sort of difficult to navigate. But I guess as long as you can talk about it or even be able to take a step back and go, oh, okay, me doing this might make me feel better, but that's not how, you know, my husband or my wife would do it. She does that, and kind of respecting that, I think, is really important. But yeah, marriages don't break up because the child has died. Rubbish.
And how do you go with trusting people to look after your children again after something like this happens?
Oh, God, no. No snowflakes are never out of my sight. The kids started Community Crèche not long before they were two, and I really second-guessed whether that was the right thing to do. And believe me, I looked at all of the entrances in the building. It's one story. It all inches onto outside. This is New Zealand. It's quite different from Qatar. But, yeah, I felt sick. I felt absolutely terrified. But, yeah, I'm a lot more nervous with them going in the car with other people than I have ever been with anyone. I'm a bit of a control freak about, you know, you're allowed to drive them around our neighbourhood, but you're not going on the motorway. I spent many years working on a ship, and then I was on the emergency response team for Qatar Airways, so I've always been kind of conscious of safety things. And I was conscious of it walking in chimpanzee. I checked, I asked about first aid, I asked if, you know, I looked at the smoke, the sprinklers and things like that. I didn't think to ask about, so what are your emergency evacuation drills? Which I would ask now. But no, I mean, we're really fortunate that when I started studying, our nanny from Qatar was able to get a visa to work in New Zealand, so she's been here for 3 years.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's fantastic. And that must be amazing for her to see you with a family again after seeing that loss.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not even that she saw it. She experienced it because she lived with, well, the moment we came back from Qatar, and you know, I'll never forget walking in the house from the hospital and having to tell her that there was a fire and that the children wouldn't be coming home. You know, there's all sorts of moments that you never forget, like having to phone. I had to wait several hours to phone my parents back in New Zealand because of the time difference. So I literally had to, but being conscious that it was starting to hit the news. So how do I call early enough they beat the news, but late enough that they can probably have the last decent night's sleep they'll have for a long time?
That is something that doesn't happen if you're at home, right? It's something that is a very uniquely expat thing.
Yeah, it is.
I can't imagine the anguish for your parents of just wanting to get to you.
Yeah. No, I can't imagine it either. It's, you know, it's almost doubly so for grandparents because they experience all the same grief as parents do. And, you know, for my parents, these are, you know, I was late having children and they were their only grandchildren. So for that to happen was, yeah. So some conversations you can relive in your head and it'd be really nice not to have to. So I sort of age my parents overnight, basically. And I wonder with my mum getting sick, just, you know, how much things like that contribute to just your body almost filling with poison.
Jane, could you ever imagine going off and being expats again now?
No, not really. No, I mean, we've been, the community that we've moved into, we're in a really lovely part of Auckland. We know pretty much everybody in our street and lots of other people in the neighbourhood, and the kids are just starting to get, you know, little friends in their same age group. It's, no, I don't think I'd want to move. I'm quite happy, very happy here.
Do you ever have that moment of someone brings up Qatar and they don't know your story?
Yeah, it's more frequent now because it was so prominent in the media here that, you know, you kind of couldn't walk down the street without people recognising you. And that was, in some ways, it was really nice because, you know, I remember being in a cafe having a drink with my mother not long after the funeral, and this man came up to me and said, "I've got triplets myself. I just need to give you a hug," which was... Yeah, I mean, people were amazing, but if you're sort of wanting to just be a normal person, not this person, this horrible thing has happened to, that can be a little bit tough. Because I think people forget eventually you do become a normal person again, not this kind of in pit of horrible things happening. But I mean, most people were. I used to get a lot of, "Have we met befores?" and that's the really difficult one when you say, "No, I don't think so." And it's like, "You look really familiar." And I mean, what am I going to say? "Yeah, we were really lucky to be on the news because our children were killed in a fire in Qatar." It may not even be that. And that's a little bit more awkward because I'm not quite sure. And it's a tough one is when people ask how many children I have. That's not always the easiest one to respond to. And sometimes I'll quite often say I've got the two with me. And it just depends if people say, "Oh, they're your first children," and I say no, and they ask about the others, then I can just say, but it just depends on how ready I am to talk about what happened. And kind of what situation it's in. I'd never say that, "Oh, yes, these are my first," with Poppy and Parker at all. But it's just a matter of how, I guess, the questions people ask as to what...
Yes.
What can come up. Because it's really confronting for people, and a lot of people don't know what to say, and it's really upsetting, And it's upsetting for other people as well. It's in some ways, I think now it can be more upsetting for somebody else who doesn't know, because they don't know, A, if they've asked something that's hurtful to me, or then, you know, that, in that second they look at their own kids and that
you know, in that instant that we kind of realise that, you know, the idea of their mortality pops in.
Yes, yes. And that's exactly it, Jane, because you have lived everybody's worst nightmare. And it is everybody's worst nightmare. Do you know there's anyone with kids? It's the unimaginable. Do you talk often to the twins about the triplets?
In some ways. We've got pictures up. They see videos occasionally. They're only three, so their concept of death is, you know, it's pretty limited. When my mum died, when they ask, you know, where's Nana, which they still do, and Nana was sick in hospital, and is Nana out of hospital? Well, yes, she is. Where is she? And I said, well, Nana died. And we actually now would say that, you know, if they asked where Nana is, we would say that she's taking care of Lily Jackson and Will.
I think the fact that you're doing counselling and gone on with that, just when you said the bit about and you walked out thinking, well, how would I do this better and how would I change it? Mm-hmm. Obviously something stayed with you all through that of I want to do something hoping that someone else doesn't have any of the experiences I had.
Yeah, that's a huge part of healing, I think, as well. Is you know, there'll never be any, you know, there'll be no good that comes from that situation at all. However, I think it's really honouring the kids and their memory that might get to work with some other people who are far earlier in their experience of something really traumatic, of giving them that hope that, you know, you can hold these little people with you, but eventually you will be okay. And I'm no smarter or stronger or well-equipped than anybody else. So, you know, if I can do it, God, anyone must be able to. So I would hope that, you know, that might give people some hope.
Hi everyone, it's Nikki. As Kirsty said earlier, we're doing things a little bit differently today, so I'm going to introduce myself. Hi, I'm in Hamburg this morning and Kirsty's back in Doha. And because of the nature of this episode and the very emotional content, I have listened to this before right now. So I have had some time to digest, think about and react to it. What I think is there's nothing really you can say after something like that. It's an almost unimaginable situation, and there's no way to understand how you or I can't understand how I would react or even recover from it. Kirsty, you were in Doha that day. I remember sitting in my study in Durban in South Africa reading a blog post that you wrote about it and crying. How did that day go for you and other expats in Doha?
That day was... Do you know, there's so many things about that day. It was a different time when I think back to 2012, because Doha is such a developing city. Doha looked very different back in that day, and my life was very different back in that day. You know, my children were so much younger. For me, on that day, I was sitting in a coffee shop in a different mall. The thing that was different in my life then was I relied on Twitter a lot more for my news, and there was a news service here that was just sort of getting up and running, a local news service called Doha News, and there was a very strong group of Twitter people in Doha that talked about, you know, what was going on, because we just didn't see it. You know, Facebook was different then, you know, things didn't pop up in your feed in the same way. So for me, that morning, I was sitting writing in a coffee shop. I had taken my own children to school as well, and there was this conversation that was happening on Twitter of that someone had seen smoke at Villaggio, and you just sort of saw all these things sort of pop up of someone was at the shopping centre and they were saying, oh, the alarms keep going off, but nobody's moving, like nothing's happening, but these alarms keep going off. And then I think one of the first signs was someone talked about being in a clothes shop and going in to try something on and coming out and the entire store was empty. And they thought, hang on, what's going on? And it was because they had evacuated in that time, but because the smoke became visible. Yeah.
But they didn't remember the people in the dressing room.
No, no. Something like this had never happened before. And it's become very obvious that procedures weren't in place for this sort of situation. So from what I gathered from listening to people's accounts on Twitter who were there, was that, you know, smoke started to make its way through the mall, the fire alarms were going off, people got out of there, but perhaps there wasn't that same level of care. So maybe in a fashion sort of clothing store, the staff hadn't been trained of what they would do, so they wouldn't have gone into the change rooms to check if people were there. But what happened was it became more and more distressing as the day went on, in that people started to talk of the nursery. You know, yep. Someone said, you know, people started asking questions. You know, someone said something about there's a children's nursery in there and has anyone seen, and or someone's looking for their children, or there's a mum here out the front. Do you know, and you started to get that sick, awful feeling.
Yeah, I'm getting, you know, where, with you talking about it now, yeah. It's making me feel.
Yeah. Sick. Yeah. And the thing is, Doha's very, very flat. So you could have stood outside your home anywhere in Doha and seen the smoke sort of billowing from Villaggio. So it was very visible that there was something terrible happening. And, of course, then we went through the, yes, the children are out, and I think there may have been some confusion because there had been a school trip there that day and young children were there, but and they had made their way out, but they weren't the children in the nursery. They were children that were visiting that day. And I remember there was someone sort of tweeting that there was a woman standing out the front and she was screaming that these children were in there, but she was getting told, no, you know, no problem. So in that way, it was incredibly distressing as a mother, because, you know, I think something happens when you become a mother and you hear stories and you start to imagine those stories, there is something that makes it 20 times worse. Yeah. You know, I think about movies I can no longer watch.
Exactly. And
yeah. So that was happening. And then just before I went to pick up the children from school, someone who had a connection with the hospital said, because everybody was saying, oh, it's okay, everybody's out, and someone, and the thing is, I've never gone back to read any of this and I don't want to, but I remember someone said, this is far worse than any of us can imagine. And you knew that they knew.
Yeah.
And they were just trying to get people to shut up, because, you know, that's the worst thing in something like this is
the speculation.
The speculation, right? And the speculation is revolting if people have it wrong. And, I remember reading that and thinking something terrible has happened. I got to the school to pick up my children and, you know, you can imagine the conversation was rife. Everybody was saying, oh, did you hear about the fire? And I remember someone who really thought that they were in the know, so saying, oh, it's all fine, you know, everybody's out, and saying to her, it's not, there's something terrible has happened. And within hours we knew. I have a very good friend that lived on the same compound as Jane, and Jane and I have a lot of mutual friends. And I had seen Jane before because as a Kiwi, there is like an Australian-New Zealand sort of association, and I can remember Jane and remember because she had triplets. Yeah. She was highly memorable, yes, because you look at the woman with triplets and go, whoa. And she was also, she is beautiful. She was this highly energetic and is highly energetic, blonde, gorgeous bombshell. And I remember seeing her and thinking, wow, look at that woman. So, you know, she was someone that you could remember straight away when someone said, can you remember Jane with the triplets? It was like, yes, I do remember seeing her. But, yes, a good friend of mine sort of lived a few doors down, and she confirmed that that was the case. And, you know, it was just
how does that go then? So you pick up your kids from school, like you get them home, your friend texts you or confirms, or something happens and you find out, then what do you do? Like, what happens next with your kids, with the whole situation?
Yeah, because you don't want to tell your children, but you know that your children are going to know the minute they get to school the next day. So I remember we talked about it as a family. I'm pretty sure that by the end of that night, I wrote that post. Yeah. I wrote a post called Numb with Grief, because that was what a girlfriend of mine said to me. Because you imagine, you all just want to bond together because the unimaginable has happened. And I remember a girlfriend of mine said, I just feel numb with grief for those families. So I wrote the post late that night. We decided that we would go to the memorial the next day. Not my little people at that stage. I went with my girls, who were 12 and 10. Yeah. At the time. Bizarrely, Nikki, when we were doing the research for this to go back and find the news, you know, headings and go back to sort of look at things, there is a link on the Daily Mail, and it shows you a group of people all together. They're down at a place called Aspire Park, which is just across from Villaggio. And hundreds and hundreds of people went the next day together because you just wanted to form as a group and as a community. I've never experienced anything like this in the expat community, of just you do just all want to get together and be together. And I can remember going to sit down at the park with my daughters and with friends and their children, and just being with, you know, my husband's friends and lots of men as well as women, and everyone was just sobbing. But everyone was sobbing because it was just so awful.
How did that come about, that memorial? So
I think it was just a group of people. Do you know, someone said we should get together, and I think there was more of a conversation. I know it was on the bottom of that post that I wrote. Yeah. We said we would get together at Aspire at, you know, 4 o'clock or whatever it was. And you know, more people the word just got round that we were all going to get together there. And then, of course, Jane and Martin came. And which, you know, I look at her now. She says that she's not special and that she just, you know, gets on and does what she does and that anyone would. But I think right from the get-go, you can see that Jane is a unique person. And she talked about when she left the hospital and that her immediate thought was, I'm going to come back here and put better processes in place. Do you know, that's a unique person that is thinking, I want to help other people who go through what I've just been through, you know, within a day. And when Jane came that day, There's sort of a few things that are really clear in my mind, but one of those was also the New Zealand community were so strong. They did a haka for them, and which you can imagine was incredibly powerful. Jane was clutching the soft toys of the triplets, and I remember her using a phrase about her arms being so empty. It was just horrendous. And of course, it's not just about Jane, it's all of those families. You know, we're only today talking about one piece of the puzzle.
And there are other families that lost more than one child as well.
Yes. So anyway, today we sort of wanted to really talk about when the unimaginable happens and what that looks like as an expat. So I think what I would really like people to remember is sort of the counselling side of things and the trauma within the community as well. You know, it feels very unresolved here. Because obviously with expat communities, people move in and out. So when I think back to that day, most of the people I was with no longer live in Doha. They've now, you know, moved on to their next location.
What about new people that come now after some families have moved away and the time has passed? Do you think new people understand what has happened or how?
No, I don't. And I find that really, really difficult in that, you know, only recently a woman was telling me she's in a special needs group, you know, children, parents of children with disabilities. And she was saying that they had organised a get together at this particular shopping centre and that one of the families who lost a child in the fire had to say, sorry, we don't do that shopping centre, and explain why. And, I don't go to that shopping centre, and I'm not here to judge those who do, but it was something that I just knew I could never go back there after what happened that day. But I am continuously asked if I want to meet there by people, and you know, and you sort of say, well, no, do you mind if we meet somewhere else? And when people ask, you know, I find it really difficult that not everybody knows what happened because it was so incredibly tragic. You know, I think I understand that within the culture here, memorials are not a thing. You know, there are no such things as gravestones or memorials. So that also means that people who go there, they don't see a memorial of what happened that day. And I can't carry on and forget, do you know, and I can't, and I can't have coffee and giggle or enjoy a meal or laugh and smile at that destination. And
yeah, that's very interesting from a cultural perspective.
Yeah,
a memorial thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Just because the way we grew up, there's memorials for lots of things, you know, wars and people and all sorts of different things.
Yes, so, yeah. And even down to the point, you know, in Australia, if there's a car accident and someone dies, there's a cross or there's flowers left on the side of the road. Well, you don't see anything like that here. It's just not part of the culture. So, you know, it was just a choice that we made of not to go there, and my family understand it. And, you know, there's that many shopping centres here. Do you know, there's so many. I don't understand the need to go to that one. And even though there's, you know, there's one right next door to it as well, that if you needed a coffee or you needed groceries or whatever, you know,
you could go to that one.
You would go to that one. So I think it's, I find that bit hard of when new people come that they weren't here for it, and so they don't understand what that shopping centre means to many of us who drive past it.
And so I think overall important here is to talk about sort of counselling and services that support services that people should seek when they feel impacted by these situations. Obviously, immediate family members like Jane and all the families involved would have had that, because that would have been seen as a need by the people looking after them and their medical, their doctors, etc. But there are lots of other people who are impacted by it, and maybe they're the people that move away, you know, the next year, but still have an impact that people can't really understand because they're not surrounded by the people that understand the feelings.
Yes, anymore. You know, you think about all the people that, because you hear all those stories after the event of, well, I usually drop my child there on that day, but on this day I chose to do this, or I used that centre for 3 years, or I did this, or I knew those people. And so I think that's really important, Nikki, right? Like, don't forget to ask for help. Get to your doctor or ask a reliable and close friend, you know, about counselling. Talk to your sister, your mother, your husband, your doctor, but don't shut yourself away and not recognise that you might need to get help as well.
Yeah, I think it's important because, you know, and there are, after we've, you know, we talked about this and we had a look around, and there are services that specialise for expatriates, probably in communities where there are large expatriate communities. So, you know, you're not always going to be able to find someone close by, but you can always go to your doctor and talk to them, and they'll always be, like, clued into the local support services for that kind of situation.
Yeah.
Hopefully in your native language. Because I don't think, you know, and that just strikes me as someone who could be impacted and then moves to another country, and then they can't talk about it with anyone who understands what they actually went through at that time.
Yeah.
I just, that just makes me feel frightened. I don't know why.
No.
But it just, you know, for them, you know, because it's so difficult moving anyway, and if there's something lingering and you can't deal with it effectively, that it can really probably have a huge impact that you don't necessarily understand.
Yeah, you know, when I was a young expat, I remember there was an older long-term female expat who was in a group that I was sort of in, and she committed suicide. And I remember distinctly the company that I worked for offering counselling to all of the wives, because it was just absolutely, as a young woman, really, really devastating, because I think we all looked at ourselves 20 years on and thought, holy moly, you know, there'd been a breakdown in the marriage and all sorts of things. And I think too often as expats, we're moving right along, do you know, like, I need to put this in this place and I'll just pack up and move on and whatever. And you do have to think about what goes along with you. But also, how do you, I think another bigger point on that is, how do you continue to live in a location where something so terrible has happened and you're not understanding the culture of how things have happened as well? How do you get through that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many different points to that as well. And it just reminds me of a similar situation, well, not nothing like happened to in Villaggio, but probably more relation to what you said, in that, you know, we lived in Hong Kong when the tsunami happened, and my husband's closest friend in the office was a German guy, and he was on holiday in Khao Lak with his wife and his son, who was the same age as our son at the time, and they were killed in the tsunami. And, you know, it took a couple of weeks to find that out, and the whole company was very impacted by it, the office in Hong Kong. And thinking back on it, there definitely should have been counselling offered for the people in the office who was really struggling sort of to deal with it. They were trying to do all the practical things, but there was this big hole of this, like, they'd just started this office in Hong Kong. He was one of the founding members, all this kind of stuff. So it was a really big impact as well. And I think, you know, because there were men and they were, you know, doing these things, but it really did have a big impact. And now, as a more experienced person and expat, I probably would have gone back and said, you know, can you guys like look into this?
Yeah, that's right. It is.
But at the time, I just sat at home crying, saying, "Oh my god," you know, like I just it's just silly.
Yeah, yeah, no, but it is. There is something to that, whether it's the Bali bombing or, you know, the underground, you know, the tube, and you do, because you can place yourself in those shoes so easily. Well, that could have been me. Do you know, that could have happened to me, that could have happened to my family. I think, you know, the thing with the fire here in 2012, every person affected was an expat. Every single one, and whether they were the childcare worker, and you know, we have to remember there were two firemen as well who died that day, but all of those families were expat families, and you know, there's not an expat mother that cannot identify with dropping your child at school and taking off to go and get some grocery shopping done, and you know, going back. We can all picture that. We can all imagine, you know, what that looks like. What we can't imagine and what is terrifying is something so devastating happening. So, yeah, you're absolutely right, Nikki. I think we need to just when these things happen. I mean, Jane was so, so good to talk to us, and I think that if there's anyone who has gone through that level of grief as well, her parting words at the end about if she can do it, and you know, I think she gave anyone who's in that situation incredible hope that you will one day smile again. But yes, I think we also have to think about the other people who've maybe been the support people within that they need to make sure that they look after themselves and get help as well. Okay, so we're going. We're going to move along now to our regular wrap up, which just seems bizarre.
It's not really a good segue into this.
No.
What we're going to do is.
Yeah, and I don't know how we do that segue or even, but I mean, we will continue on. You and I thought a lot about whether we should not perhaps do this episode, because the last thing we wanted it to be was just gratuitous. But hopefully that conversation has helped someone, because that's the intention of all of these episodes.
This week, Kirsty, you might like to know, is the 3-year anniversary of Two Fat Expats.
Really? I didn't know that. I'm just
the first episode, season one, episode one, was launched on February 4th, 2015.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So there you go. Congratulations on 2 years of Two Fat Expats.
Wow. When I think back to those first few episodes, And I wonder how many people who are listening today were with us back then for those first few episodes.
I was here.
Yeah. Just on the other side of the microphone. But yeah, I remember Sarah came over and we sat at the kitchen table, and we basically just had a chat, and we didn't have really any great format, or I think from memory we had a chat about an issue, and then we maybe talked about which blogs we were reading or what we were listening to or what we were watching. And I think it might have been sort of about episode 4 where we thought, you know, we really need to bring other people into the show.
Oh, no, but I think that's fine. And then I think you did an on the road where you recorded in the car on the way to do an interview.
Oh, we did too. We did too. That was good fun.
Long time listener, first time caller.
Now, speaking about listeners, have we had any feedback from listeners this week?
Well, we have. We've had a couple of messages from our lovely listeners this week. So we had a message on the Two Fat Expats website, which of course is www.twofatexpats.com, where you can see all our podcasts and also get the show notes, which have links to all the things we discuss. Anyway, the message was from Celine. Kirsty, you might remember Celine from Singapore, the Big Fat Expat Meetup.
Yes,
she was new to Singapore. Yeah, and came to the lunch, and she sat at the one of the I'm here by myself tables.
Yes.
But according to her message, she said a lot of the other ladies on the table had come to lunch by themselves but weren't new in Singapore.
Oh.
So she did meet some new people, but no one else struggling with the new bits. So, but she did say in a positive way, and hi, Celine, I'm here for you, that her journey is mirroring my journey because she arrived at about the same time I did. So she feels that she's got 2 to 3 people she could call in an emergency, but not that much else going on yet. So come on, Celine, we can do it. We can do it.
That is something for us to remember, though. And I think, Celine, I feel a bit embarrassed to hear that because I wish I would have known that that was the case. And,
you can't know everything.
No.
You had a lot of balls in the air that day.
But I think definitely we have to make sure then that when we have that, you know, maybe we need to have one table of I'm brand new and one table of I'm here by myself or something, or we just try and do that bit a little bit better next time.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to plan that very soon.
Yes.
Location that we'll announce details of very shortly.
Yes.
Not today.
We better have that organised by next week, I think.
Okay, so we also had 2 new iTunes reviews. One about the Disobedient Wife. So, hi, ladies. I read the Disobedient Wife. I enjoyed it very much. And I love the interview with the author that I just listened to. Well done. Now you must go and find another book with an equally interesting author to learn about.
Ooh.
So, off we go. I'll make a note.
And I think we need to make a note, Nikki, that you can have that book on audiobook so that it doesn't take us 6 months to do the next review.
I think that's true. Any book we choose has to be on Audible. Yeah.
Yes. We also had another one. It says, Two Fat Expats Rock.
Yeah, we do.
I look forward to your podcast every week. I usually listen to it on my walks through the botanic gardens and lose myself. I'm often laughing out loud and tend to get a few stares from the locals. I've been a fan since season 2, but also went back and listened to season 1. Thank you, Kirsty and Nikki. It's from Georgina in Singapore. Thank you, Georgina. She said she's just worked out how to rate and send a review.
What about podcasts? Have you been listening to other podcasts this week, Kirsty?
I have fallen in love with another podcast called the D&M, as in the D with a D and M-E-M. And it's actually a fantastic blogger who I remember from years ago, Emma Healy, and she had a blog called Emma's Brain Blog. And Emma kind of disappeared a bit. I remember seeing her all the time years ago blogging. But what she's actually done is she enrolled in a creative writing and journalism degree, and then part of that involved doing a digital audio journalism course. And she mentions on her blog when she's talking about the D&M that some of her lecturers that helped her make the D&M also made Phoebe's Fall, which we've talked about before. Phoebe's Fall is so good.
Yeah, which is why all her editing is fantastic.
It is. Her editing is really professional. So for this one, it's all about teen pregnancy in Oz, and it kind of looks at the labels that we're given, and there's some really eye-opening research. I found it really difficult. I'm gathering she's sourcing people at university when she's asking, but she's asking all these young people about what teen pregnancy means to them, or what a pregnant teen looks like. And the answers are pretty bloody awful. Did you listen to it, Nikki?
I did listen, and they're brutal. But if I think about what I'd said when I was 18 or 19, probably not going to be, not in that language, because it's modern language, but yeah, it's still, bogan's the word I'd still use.
and they obviously have no inclination that she was a teen mother. Do you know, because there's no way they would have said it to her.
I think they do. Yeah. I don't know. I have to listen to it again, but I think they do.
So the first episode I just absolutely love because it looks at what the labels are that we give teen parents, and then what people's perceived ideas and sort of really what the true statistics are of teen parents. And Emma, if I haven't mentioned it, is or was a teen parent. She's now gone on to have two other children and she's in her 30s. But she said that she found the whole thing very emotionally taxing, and that she had to kind of really examine some of the parts of her life, including her interrupted schooling. And she said that she definitely doesn't think she's the same person now that she's made the podcast as she was when she started it. So, yeah, go and have a look. It's called The D&M, and I thought it was great. What about you, Nikki? What podcasts have you listened to this week?
Yeah, I listened to two this week that I'm loving, although one was just one episode, which I always get so frustrated when there's no more episodes to listen to. But it was The Messenger, which is a podcast about an asylum seeker detained on Manus Island. And if you know anything about Australia and our the policies, the immigration policies that we have, we're really, it's very controversial and there's a lot of public discussion, but it's about a guy, he's a Sudanese asylum seeker called Aziz, and Michael Green, who's a journalist in Australia, and he got a phone, the asylum seeker got a phone, and through a series of WhatsApp voice messages. So they send each other these WhatsApp voice messages and ask and answer questions. And it's so interesting and obviously insightful, and it tells the story of how he got the phone. So, asylum seekers go to the gym, they get points, and with points they can go to a cafeteria, and then if cafeteria they can get cigarettes or whatever, and then they trade, and in the end they get a guard who works in the place to get them a phone from outside the camp. And anyway, it's quite fascinating, but there's only one episode so far, so I'm waiting for the second episode.
Wow.
So yeah, I think it's called The Messenger, and I recommend it. I'll obviously put the link in the show notes. And the other one is...
Can I just say something? Yes. One thing I was going to say. Last night at dinner, I was with Helen, who works with us, who's from Ethiopia, and my daughter. And I was also with my mother-in-law and my husband. But where this conversation gets interesting and to the point of something, because I'd love to put this out to everybody out there, because it's all going to make sense in a second, Nikki, I promise, is I was talking about, there's a show in Australia called Q&A, and a couple of days ago there had been... A woman from Sudan who had an argument with a politician from Queensland. The woman, when I say she's from Sudan, she's not, she's Australian, but she moved from Sudan when she was one. And I used the phrase when I was telling the story, there was a Sudanese woman, and my daughter said to me, "What did you just say?" And I said, "A Sudanese woman." And my daughter literally laughed at me like I was an idiot. And then she said, "Mum, you're not Sudanese, you're Sudani." And I was like, "No, you're not, you're Sudanese." And she was giggling at me. She said, "Mum, I have friends from Sudan, you're Sudani." Anyway, of course, Helen's there with us, who's from Ethiopia. And I said, "Helen, if you're from Sudan, what are you?" She said, "You're Sudani."
No.
She had never heard of Sudanese.
She'd never told you, you were saying the wrong thing.
No, but she's from Ethiopia, so you know, I guess I've never really said it in front of her.
Is she called Ethiopian? Have we got to change that too?
No, you're definitely Ethiopian. We've got that bit right. But yes, evidently it's an Australian thing. So please, if anyone out there is listening,
sorry, who's
from elsewhere, but I'm just wondering why would we have just started saying Sudanese? When
why does South Africa say Tanzania? I don't know.
Okay, continue on. Sorry, but I just found that really interesting.
Thank you to Annie for helping us out there.
Thank you, 14-year-old smarty pants daughter. Yes.
All right, the other podcast I've been listening to, which kind of ties in this week, is The Daily, which is from the New York Times. You'll remember the badly failing New York Times. And they have a new podcast, which is about a 20-minute daily podcast, and then it looks at some of the news, and then it has a slightly more in-depth look at some of the issues going on. For example, last week they did a 10-minute piece about looking for a 16-year-old boy from Afghanistan who had been photographed in Indonesia about to leave for the US as a refugee. And that was the day before the refugee ban came in the US, which has since been lifted. But the story was quite amazing. So his mother, father and sisters had been on their way to a doctor's appointment in Kabul in a taxi, and they were killed by a roadside bomb, and he was 15. So he's by himself in Afghanistan in a war, and he sold all his family possessions. And he raised $7,000 to pay people smugglers to get into Indonesia. And his goal was to get to Australia. But when he got on the boat, so he would have ended up in Manus Island with Aziz. But when he got to Indonesia, they had stopped the illegal boat people. The people smugglers had been shut down. So he registered to be a refugee, and he went through this whole process to get accepted into the US. And so there had been a picture of him in the paper, and so they tracked him down, which was amazing. So he 2 days before he was meant to fly out, the ban came in, and then there was a photo of him in the paper, so people wanted to know what happened to him. So they tracked him down, and now he's in the States. So in the following weeks,
we're going to follow up.
So, but it's just an amazing story in that it really ties in with the other podcast I was listening to and with the whole Australian immigration issues. And it was just, it's really interesting. So it's one of those things that ties together lots of different things, but it's a great podcast nonetheless.
Yeah, that sounds incredible.
Yeah.
Oh, I want to go and listen to that.
I've had a good week. Okay, what about TV, Kirsty? What are you watching on TV?
I have only just, once again, very late to the party, like 2 years late, discovered Transparent. Have you watched it?
I haven't. It's on my list of things I must watch, but I haven't.
Oh, Nikki, it is so good. It is so good. And what a great name, because it's, so for those who haven't heard of it, it's about a retired college professor who finally sort of opens up to his family that he identifies as a woman. And so hence the name Transparent. And you kind of meet his three adult children within the first episode, and they all live these very kind of LA lives. The cinematography of this television series is just beautiful. It's got that whole Californian kind of feel to it all the way through. But they are all just so self-absorbed, but they just can't see anything different in his lives because their own lives are just so huge. But yeah, there's sort of this great scene where he invites them to dinner to share his news, and that conversation just becomes all about them. And they're really dysfunctional, but the series is just sort of secret after secret that gets exposed. It's really, really funny and really, really good dialogue, brilliant acting. I'm loving it.
Is it on Amazon or Netflix? What's it?
I watched it on Stan.
Oh, on Stan.
Which, yeah. So I watch it through Stan, which is, and I don't, I never know. I need to go and find out whether Stan, I gather it translates everywhere. But you know, we have an Apple TV, and we're either sort of watching things these days on either Netflix, Stan, or iTunes. But so I've watched it on Stan. But I know because they've done season three, and I think season four. Oh no, hold it! No, season three came out in September, so you'd definitely be able to get it on iTunes. I'm sure.
Okay, well, I was not watching such a deep and thoughtful show this week. My Netflix popped up Santa Clarita Diet.
Yes.
Drew Barrymore and Timothy Olyphant. He's one of those people who you think you've seen somewhere and then you go and look him up and you're like, oh, I don't think I've actually seen him. He just looks very familiar. And wow, just wow. I read one review that said, a word of warning, do not try to eat while watching Santa Clarita Diet. Just trust me on that.
Oh, God, yeah.
And I'm a big agreeer. Yeah. I'm a big agreeer. In fact, I watched after the first episode, I was like, oh, I can't watch this anymore. And then I just watched the second episode, and then I watched the whole thing. So, and in about episode 8, I think I actually was dry heaving at one stage. But I just pushed through. So for those of you that haven't watched it yet, Santa Clarita Diet is about, well, it's about, what, it's
bizarre. That's, she's a zombie.
So she died. You don't really know how she dies. Anyway, and she's a zombie. But it's a comical take on zombies.
But it's also very, it's not dark zombie.
No.
So for me, what happened with Santa Clarita Diet was I saw Drew Barrymore get interviewed on something, and I heard her say, I was in a really dark place in my life, you know, my marriage had broken down, blah, 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 and then I got offered this television series and it just saved me because it took me to a different place and I had to be a different person, and of course that made me just want to go and watch it because I was thinking, what? And so I had no idea that it was the zombie
thing. Neither did I.
Or any of that.
It.
So when you start watching it, it kind of looks a little bit like, what was that? Oh, Desperate Housewives.
Yes.
It kind of looks
Truman
a little
shows.
Bit like that. Yeah. It's sort of, they're in the suburbs, they're going to work, they're married, they've got kids, it's all very pretty, you know, it's all lovely. And then she starts throwing up all over the floor.
Yeah.
And you're like, what? Yeah, and then all of a sudden she's eating a colleague.
Yeah, it's just, yeah. But it's kind of hooking. Like I was like, after the first episode, I was like, I can't really. And then I was like, okay, one more, because I think everyone in my family was doing something else. I was like, okay, I'll watch one more. And then I just kept watching the whole thing. Anyway, what about social media? What do you got on social media?
Okay, well, I don't think there's a person on this planet that hasn't seen Melissa McCartney on Saturday Night Live doing Sean Spicer. But she's just so, so good at it. God, she's so, so good at it. But what I was going to say about social media is just how much I have really started to love The Daily Show and Saturday Night Live again. Do you know, like, I think they now have this fantastic content.
Great material, that's right.
They've got great material. And Trevor Noah has just been slaying me on a daily basis on The Daily Show. This morning he's done, and I think the guy's name, and I'm sorry because it really is just this morning, Miller, is it? Who's
yeah.
been?
Oh, he's yeah. fantastic.
Oh, my gosh. Anyway, so that's all been good. But there is something I've seen on social media that I'd love to share. And there's a little 50-second video on the French and eating. And it just sort of shows you, I think, yeah, it'll take you no more. Well, 50 seconds it's going to take you. It's not even going to take you a minute to watch it. So it shows you how the French sort of put aside 2.5 hours a day towards eating, and that 80% of their time eating is spent with other people, which in contrast to Americans who spend 75 minutes eating a day, it tends to be very rushed, and 60% of that time is spent eating alone. And they were saying about eating shouldn't be a chore, it should be a social experience. And I think that why it sort of stuck with me was, you know, I have a daughter who spent 6 weeks in France recently living with a French family. And she was saying about how every night, you know, how they would sit down to dinner and then they would pull out, you know, this vast array of cheese, and you would have, sort of a slither of cheese and sit and chat and whatever. And I was thinking that with our family, we do sit down together every night to eat. But quite often we are slamming that in between softball practice, saxophone lessons, clarinet lessons, netball trials, JV trials. Do you know there isn't that slow, comfortable sort of thing. I just thought it was a really interesting look at how we need to make eating social.
Yes, I'd like to time myself. I don't think I eat for that long. I eat probably a lot, but not for that long.
That's what I was thinking too. I was thinking maybe it's that whole pushing food into your mouth. Yeah. And the The thing, I'm guessing the French aren't eating their lunch in the car. Well, Nikki, we got through it, and my apologies to anyone with our segue between what we usually do each week and our content of what we had for the beginning of our show, but I don't think there was ever going to be a comfortable way that we could segue on to that, was
it, Nikki? I don't think so, no. Anyway, we'll be back next week.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Two Fat Expats is very grateful to Jane Weeks for sharing her story with us. The news clips at the beginning of the episode were taken from Al Jazeera and BBC Archives. Music is Lay You Down from Will Halliday and can be found on SoundCloud. Bye, see you next week. So